Good afternoon. So, last week, Professor Tonovich covered this idea of multiple issue out of order processors. So processors which would start more than one instruction in every cycle and would also execute instructions as their operands became ready. And we learned that the sort of way this would work is that we'd have a pipeline like we were used to. And the first part of the pipeline would be in an order part, meaning that it would still execute instructions in the order they were written in the program, as long as all branch prediction worked correctly. So we fetch instructions, and we do this registry naming step in order to expose dependencies and make it practical to implement our logic that would detect when instructions were ready. And the key attribute that our instructions would have after this registry naming step is that each register in the renamed version would be written exactly once. So if you want to figure out whether values are ready for an instruction, we say, what registers does it use? Have those been written yet? If so, its operands are ready. If not, they aren't. And this makes that logic of figuring out what instructions we can run when a lot more practical. So we have this out of order part where we look at what instructions have values that are ready. We take those instructions in some order and actually run them on our execution units, our ALUs, our ports into the cache, and so on. And then we have a final in-order part we call commit, where we deal with finishing up the instructions. And the most notable thing that happens here is that this is how we populate the list of registers that are free for the renaming step. Because a problem, of course, if we only write each register once, we'd quickly run out. So to avoid that, we're going to figure out what instructions are finishing. And when we know a register is no longer in use, we can put it back on the list of free registers to use for renaming. So we know its value, is effectively empty right now, because nothing is going to be using it. And we learned that there's this sort of model you can have about how your programs are executed. And one way of representing that is this notion of a data flow graph, where we draw this node for each operation, and we draw edges between these nodes, indicating when where data flows, where we send the result of an operation to another operation. And we make these graphs. If we draw all our edges sort of going downwards, sort of the deepest path tells us something we call, or at least our textbook calls, a latency bound, which is, in order to finish these operations, we need to do, this operation, then this operation, and this operation following that path. And that can tell us sort of, what a minimum time we'd expect a processor to take to run this. And if we look at that graph, we can also kind of figure out what things don't depend on each other, kind of independent arms of that graph. And these are things that we could do in parallel, and kind of how wide our graph gives us a rough idea of, how many execution units our processor would need in order to actually execute this sort of with everything in parallel that can be to actually achieve that latency bound. And some consequences of this sort of model of processor operation are that there are these optimizations you can do. So one is what our textbook calls reassociation. And that's if we have something like A times B times C times D, we can choose, because times is commutative and some other operations like addition are too, we can choose the order we do that in to expose more parallelism, to have more operations that can be done at once, to make that data flow graph be less deep. And we can apply the same concept to loops. So commonly in loops, we'll accumulate some value, like add it to a sum, or some other operation that combines values from different iterations of the loop. And if we do this in kind of the naive way, we all end up requiring sort of one iteration of the loop to execute after the other in some sense. That this might be our longest chain of dependencies in that data flow graph. And we can instead sort of divide up those accumulations into multiple things and add them together at the end, which will shorten our data flow graph. And And from the processor's perspective, we're giving the processor more things that can be done in parallel, hopefully, and therefore it should execute faster, assuming we have extra execution units to use. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
What physically allows for the multiple issue processor? Is it the addition of more execution units?
So question, what allows for the multiple issue processor? So to have a multiple issue processor, we need to have more of a lot of things. So we need to be able to fetch more stuff, and we need to somehow to do branch prediction, we need to do some kind of fancy branch prediction where, like, if there's a branch in the middle of that stuff, we somehow, you know, predict that and fetch the two chunks. So that's one thing we have to implement. When we're doing things like, if we're doing things like renaming, we need to do that for multiple instructions at once, even if those instructions have dependencies. So we need, like, a bunch of extra, like, comparators to handle that that we might not otherwise need. And we need the additional execution units, probably because we need to be able to usefully be, if we start two instructions at once, to actually be able to do their work at once. So in this class, we only talked about multiple issue processors if they're also out of order. There are designs which are multiple issue that aren't out of order, so those are simpler, but in those, you still need some sort of division of the execution units. A simple way we could do that is a design where we say that, well, you know, some instructions use the ALU and some use the data cache, for example. So we could have a design where we have one ALU and one data cache, and we say that you, the compiler, are going to put your instructions in pairs. The first instruction of the pair will use the ALU, the second will use the data cache. And that's a design idea known as very long instruction word. There have been processors like that, and that's kind of the simplest way you can do multiple issue. So in that case, we haven't really duplicated the execution units, but we've sort of split them all out into separate slots. But we still need to duplicate the other things, like all the instruction fetch logic, and most notably, the register read and write. We need to have more width for that. Okay, other questions, follow-ups? Yeah. Can I go over number two about the quiz? Sure. Let's pull up the quiz. Number two. Okay. So this is asking if we want to use multiple accumulators. So the sort of multiple accumulator transformation is the idea that we're going to have different iterations of the loop of the original loop use different accumulators. So this is something that's only going to make sense after we unroll. And a thing to note here is that there's only two registers of the ones listed that are shared between different iterations of the loop. If we look at, for example, R10, which is not the answer, we load a new value into R10 every iteration. So there's no accumulating. Like, we get a value for R10 in one iteration, and then we're done with it. It doesn't get used in the next iteration, so there's not going to be a benefit to us to have some sort of multiple accumulators for R10, because R10 values are independent for each iteration. There's no accumulating. There's nothing like adding up a sum or something like that. So the only thing that looks like it's being accumulated are R13 and RAX. Those are the only things where we compute a value in one iteration of the loop and use it in the next. In the case of R13, you know, this is the answer. You might say, so why not REX? So REX is our loop index. If we look at this loop, this is basically a for loop from 100 subtracting down to 0. And when we do loop unrolling, we probably have a better way of handling that because we can predict the value in any iteration. We probably aren't going to have like two indices that we merge together at the end. But that idea would make sense for R13, where we're, you know, adding different values to R13 that we don't know in advance, you know, so we actually have to do the addition. We can't do something simpler of just saying, oh, it changes by 2 every time. Okay. follow-ups or other questions? Yes, back there. Go over the first question, sure. So this is saying if we want to optimize this loop by enrolling, you know, what should we make an extra copy of what instructions with changes like to offsets, et cetera? And this is basically asking, where's the body of the loop, right? Because remember, when we do unrolling, we don't necessarily want to duplicate all the indexing stuff. We're going to change that for unrolling. But where's the body of the loop? And you know, our loop is from here to here, and our indexing stuff is just this. We're decrementing our I, what we assume would be I if this were a for loop, and doing our comparison. So everything else is the loop index that if this were like a for loop, this would be the body of the for loop. And that's what we're going to duplicate. And this happens to contain an if statement. But that's something that if it's part of the body of the for loop, that's what we duplicate when doing the loop unrolling. And well, if we duplicated this if statement, we probably want to change the name of this label, but that's kind of the same thing as like changing offsets and so on to deal with the, oh, we have one version for I and one for I plus one. Does that answer your question?
I was wondering why you wouldn't have to change instruction 8.
So question is, why wouldn't we have to change instruction 8? We would have to change instruction 8, but we wouldn't copy it. We would make an extra copy of it, most likely. Okay. I think it's fine to propose that instead of doing the thing where we change the subtract to subtract 2 instead of 1, it would be fine to propose we have two subtract 1s, in which case you would answer F, and I checked who did that. And so that would be fine, but you wouldn't want to answer like to duplicate this instruction, because that doesn't make sense. But probably if we were unrolling, we'd notice the pattern with the index and change it to be something a little more intelligent rather than having like two subtract 1s. Even though, we could have two subtract 1s, but presumably if we were enrolling, we have to have figured that out anyways. But we don't really have to have figured out what the body of the loop is really doing. We just change some numbers in it. Other questions? Yes.
Do you kind of go for answer B? What would happen there?
So question, what with answer B? So what's wrong with answer B? So with answer B, we're proposing that this if statement here doesn't get duplicated. So that means that we have one if statement. So it depends how you lay out these instructions, but what that seems to suggest to me is that we're loading index I from the array that's represented by R8, and we're conditionally negating it, and then we're loading index I plus 1, and we're not, right? Because there wouldn't be the code to do that. And that wouldn't be equivalent to what the original loop did, right?
Okay.
So we need to duplicate that, because that's part of the logic that computes this R10 value here that we need to add. And I just don't see how you can do that without having two copies if you also have two copies of the initial loads. Like, I guess you could do something like turn it into a function or something like that, but you know, that seems to be going against the idea of loop unrolling, reducing overhead instructions like, you know, calls and returns or jumps and so on. Okay. Other questions?
We want to go to
there. Okay, so a logistical note on some regrades. So due to a technical issue, it's possible I lost a small number of LinkISA homework regrades submitted to the website on the submission site. Please, if you submitted one, check if it's there, and if it's not, check if that's reflected on the submission site. If it's not, email me. This shouldn't recur, but just a configuration issue that cause grades to silently go nowhere and not show an error message. And my backups are pretty complete, but probably not 100% complete. Okay, so another logistical thing that's maybe more generally relevant, we have some assignments coming up that are performance homeworks. There's an assignment to rotate an image and to smooth, to blur an image. And if you looked at the schedule, you'll notice that both of these are due next week. So what's going on there is that there's two parts to the smooth assignment, and the first part is due with rotate. These are weighted as one homework assignment, so basically rotate's going to be worth 75% of a normal homework assignment, and the first part of smooth is going to be worth 25% of a normal homework assignment. And for both of these assignments, sort of the basic idea is that we give you some code, and your goal is to make a faster version of that code, and we're going to time it on my machine, and you need to get a certain speed up on my machine, compiled in a certain way, and for the most part, we don't care how you do it. Just needs to get X faster, though obviously we have some ideas of how you might do it. For rotate, we're not going to give you much guidance. For smooth, we have some very specific instructions that we'd recommend, though if you find some other way to do it, that's fine. So these all deals with images. The way we're going to represent images is as arrays of pixels. Our pixels have a byte representing a red, green, blue, and alpha component for each pixel, and are a matrix similar to the kinds of matrices you saw when we were talking about cache blocking and matrix multiplying. So same kind of representation. It's going to be a flat array for a 2D thing. And our rotate code looks like this. You might wonder, what's that RIDX thing? So this is the code written by our textbook authors. And there's this weird RIDX thing. And basically, this is going to be equivalent to I times dim plus j. Just a function which resolves into that. And it's a preprocessor macro. So it's not a function, but it's a macro. And I don't think we really go over macros in 2150, so I'll talk to you about that, tell you what they are, just so you know, so when you're looking at this code, you aren't confused about what's going on. So a preprocessor macro, you set with this pound define. So here I have a macro that looks like a function that's double of x, and I say that's equivalent to x times 2. So after I have that pound define, if I write double and parentheses some value, in this case, about 100, that's going to expand into 100 times 2. And I really mean expand. It's going to be a text substitution. And this macro here is actually, it's not a very good one. Because of the text substitution, it can do things that you might not expect. So for example, if I call it with 3 plus 3, it expands into 3 plus 3 times 2. And that's, again, a text substitution, so the result is going to be 9. Because it's literally going to send that code to the compiler, which is probably not what the person who wrote this double macro would have expected. So because of that, when you look at C code out in the wild that uses macros like this, you'll often see it using what seems like unnecessary parentheses, but they really aren't unnecessary. They're really very important, maybe a reason why this macro system was not such a great idea. And I have the wrong comment here. And RIDX is one of these macros, so it's just x, y, n, x times n plus y. Now, this is what our textbook authors use in their original code. I think it makes the code fairly readable, but you don't have to use it. If you just want to write out the multiplication and addition, that's 100% okay. But it's kind of important to know for, you know, thinking about loop unrolling, cache blocking, and so on. So questions about this macro? Macros in general? Okay. So notes on the performance assignment. You're going to submit a file. It can have multiple variants in the file. We'll just time all of them and take the best one. please don't delete stuff that works. I don't like hearing, you know, I had this version that was really fast, but then I changed it and it got slower. You can make copies. You can have both copies in the same file still. So do that. The speed up is going to be measured on my machine. So I have a testing machine. It's described in a good amount of detail in the assignment write-up if you want to know, like, how big is its cache, what type of processor does it have, and so on. Since machines are slightly different, the results on my machine may be different than your machine. Generally, as long as you're using the same type of compiler like the department machines do, you should get similar results in the sense that usually something that's faster on the a lot faster on the department machines will also be a lot faster on my machine, but maybe not in the same way. Not to the same, you know, exact ratios and so on. We have a web viewer for the results on my machine, so you can like submit something to the submission site and see what the actual performance is on my machine rather than guessing. And there's a threshold you need to achieve on my machine, so you probably want to do that, you know, not at the last minute. And generally, you know, for when we don't have more specific advice with the smooth assignment, you know, try techniques that seem applicable. Remember to vary numbers. Just because cache blocking doesn't work when you choose, you know, blocks of 1,000 doesn't mean it won't work with a different number. So, like, and same thing with loop unrolling. If you unroll the loop 100 times and 2 times and those both don't work, maybe you should try other numbers. And note that some techniques combine well. You know, so, you know, we can do loop unrolling and cache blocking together. We can do loop unrolling and multiple accumulators together. We kind of can't do them separately. Well, multiple accumulators separately from loop unrolling. So you're probably not just going to do, you know, each thing kind of separately. So questions about the performance assignments? So last time we finished up, we're looking at data flows. So here I have some assembly, and I drew the corresponding data flow. And basically what I did is I looked at each assembly instruction. I made it a node in this graph. I drew edges coming from where its inputs come. In the case of the move, I split it up into a compute address step and a load step. This seems to be something a lot of processors do in practice. So those would be kind of separate execution unit operations. And the advantage of graphs like this is that we can kind of quickly answer questions, you know, about what might be possible on processors, even if we're not like figuring out the exact schedule. So like I need more detail to like say exactly how long will it take to execute with these execution units, but I can get a quick approximation. And one thing I can try to figure out quickly is what's our latency bound here? So I'll give you a minute or two, maybe more. So what is the latency bound based on the timings I have here? I say add and compute address take 1 cycle of latency. Our multiplies take 3 cycles of latency. So they might be like pipeline. We might be able to do a lot at a time on the same ALU. But when we do one, we get an answer 3 cycles later. And the same thing with loads. Loads take 3 cycles. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks our latency bound is at least 5 seconds? At least 5 cycles, 5 or more. Okay. At least 6 cycles. At least 7. At least 8. At least 9. Okay, so we have kind of reasonable consensus that we have 8, some exceptions. So to do this, I just look at all the paths from our top to the bottom, and sort of our two notable ones are this one, this add queue to this compute address to this load to this multiply, and this one, this add queue through this multiply through this multiply. Those are the ones that have, you know, seem to have the highest totals, and we have 7 for this add queue to this multiply to this multiply, and 8 for this add queue to this address computation to this load to this multiply. So 8's our highest, so our latency bound is 8 cycles. That, you know, with these latencies, we need at least 8 cycles to execute this, no matter how much we can do in parallel. Now, you know, we might also be limited by what we can do in parallel, because that depends on the sort of, you know, how many execution units we have free and so on. And this diagram is also helpful for reasoning about that. So the second question here is, what can we do at the same time as compute address? And what we look for there is, the things that are sort of after compute address here, we can't do at the same time because they depend on the result. The things that are, if we follow backwards from compute address, we can't do at the same time because we couldn't start compute address until they're done. So the things we could do at the same time as compute address is going to be everything else. That potentially the processor could execute all of these operations in parallel with the compute address operation. Doesn't mean that's going to be what it does or the optimal way of executing this, but that's sort of in the range of things an out-of-order processor could do. So questions about reasoning about this diagram or these answers? Yes? Question, the general rule that if it's not a descendant or ancestor, you can possibly do it in parallel? Yeah. So if there's no dependency to it, we should be able to do it in parallel. It doesn't necessarily mean that things will work out that way, but it should be possible. Yes. So the question is this a diagram for showing a particular processor? So this is a diagram where, to make this diagram, we didn't need to think about what the processor was. We just needed to know what are the operations. So I would say it's processor generic. It's most easy to apply to sort of an out-of-order processor, because if we think of an in-order processor, well, that latency bound isn't actually very useful because we're going to execute the instructions in the order they're in the program, and that's how long they're going to take. But this is something that we can draw without any knowledge of what the sort of processor architecture looks like. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, when I say what can be done at the same time, does that mean they're all happening at the same time, or pick one? So it could be anything from none of them to all of them, because unless we have some other constraints. Or actually, well, it can't be all of them. And I can tell it can't be all of them, because we can't do this add and this multiply at the same time. So it can't be all of them. But other than those sorts of constraints, you know, potentially there's, you know, all those sorts of possibilities. In practice, if you wanted to figure out exactly what would happen, we need to go to more detail about how our processor worked. And that would be something like how we like reasoned about instruction queues last week. Doing that sort of exercise would be how we figured out what would really happen. But if we're thinking about optimizing code, which is our main topic right now, that's usually not an exercise you're going to have time to do on any non-trivial piece of code. And so you'll do some sort of more abbreviated analysis like this. Other questions? Okay, so I'm going to go to some different topics on optimization. I'm going to talk a bit about compilers and how compilers do. So if you run, say, GCC without telling it to optimize, and you look at the assembly it generates, it's actually pretty horrible. So here's something that's like the loop we were working with when we talked about loop unrolling. And the assembly that GCC generates without optimizations stores the variable A on the stack. So that pointer is stored on the stack. And it's retrieved every time we want to read from A. So we want to read from A of I. We do the whole computation of that, including multiplying by 8, retrieving the pointer A from the stack, retrieving, actually loading from the array, and we store the sum on the stack and add to it on the stack. So this is really inefficient and does things that you would never do writing assembly by hand, probably, because you know about registers and you probably try to use them before you try to use the stack. If we tell GCC to optimize for size, we get this much more reasonable assembly, which we used for our loop unrolling example. That's much easier to read. But this is optimizing for size. This is not what the compiler does when we say we want to make this code fast. So what does it do when we say we want to make the code fast? So if we look at an old version of GCC with optimization level 2, whatever that means, see that it doesn't do any of the techniques we learned about, but it does something where it adjusts the comparison, so there's a compare and a conditional jump in the loop, so our loop is has just one jump instruction versus this size version, which had 2. And to do that, it needed to make the code longer. It added a special case for when we execute the loop 0 times. But this is something compilers are pretty good at. They're pretty good at figuring out how to tease out those extra compare instructions. That's a pretty easy transformation to do. Now, if you've looked at compiler documentation and also kept up with GCC, you might know GCC version numbers go much higher than 5 these days, and optimization levels go higher than 2. So let's take a look at, say, a more recent version of GCC at optimization level 3. So it generates code that uses this padq instruction. And if you look up what that does, that is an instruction that adds 2 pairs of long. So it's one instruction that does 2 adds at once. So it's basically unrolled this loop and used this fancy instruction that's 2 adds in one instruction. We'll learn more about those instructions next time when we talk about vector instructions. The compiler just knows to do this. Also, there's a lot of setup and code and finishing code to make that work. If you pass the compiler an option to say, oh, I'm compiling for a recent Intel processor, I don't care about compatibility with older processors, then it will in fact use this instruction, vpadq, which if you look it up, that adds not 2 pairs of longs, but 4 of them. So it's 4 adds in one instruction. And if you read up on the GCC options, we can do some more things. So we talked about unrolling loops. Well, GCC has an option to do that. And it will do all those other optimizations and unroll the loop. And there's other compilers out there too. So Clang has a little less variability in its optimization options. So it just has optimize. But if I sort of say optimize for a modern processor, I get a massively unrolled loop, unrolls the loop 16 times, and uses these special instructions that do four adds at once. So it seems like, well, the compilers are doing a pretty good job here. Like, and they can do loop unrolling, which makes sense, because loop unrolling is really mechanical, right? It makes sense that we could code a compiler to just do that. So why don't we just turn on the optimization flags and not worry about teaching you about loop unrolling and so on? Why can't we just have the compilers do this for us? And I'm going to talk about, well, compilers are good at different kinds of optimizations. There's things that compilers have trouble with, and we're going to talk about a couple different cases where, you know, humans have a relatively easy time doing things, and compilers have a lot of trouble. And this is because compilers are working under some limitations that humans don't have. So one of these is that compilers need to make your code be correct. And you might say that, well, this isn't really a limitation, right? Don't I need to do that when I'm optimizing your code? Well, compilers need to worry about corner cases. And we kind of saw an example of this earlier. When we looked at this code, we have this special case for returning zero. You, optimizing this code by hand, would probably say, no one's going to call this function with a negative number, you know, but the compiler actually needs to worry about that sort of thing. Because that's what the code's written to do. It needs to generate code which does that, even if that sort of call to this function doesn't make any sense. And we'll see this come up in some more serious ways. Another limitation is that a lot of the ways compilers do optimizations are pretty intensive to do in a lot of code. So often, the compiler's optimizer will work primarily a method at a time. And even when the optimizer can work between different methods, if we have code in different files, if we remember how object files work, if we want to use that sort of object file idea, well, I can't, when I'm writing the code for foo.o, I can't use my knowledge of what's going to be in bar.o because that could change, right? I could use any version of bar.o. So that's going to limit what optimizations we can do. Another thing is that the compiler doesn't have very much information about what values for like loops will be or what inputs will be. So if it sees n, it has to guess that n's going to be big. You as a human probably have some idea what the code's meant to be for and would know, oh, this n is going to be big. This is an important loop that I should unroll. The compiler just says, there's a variable here. It doesn't know if that's going to be typically a million or typically like two. Also, a lot of the optimizations we've seen are making sort of code size trade-offs. And if we did this kind of optimization for every single loop in our code, our program would be very big. And this would probably end up running slower because we'd have more to load, more instruction cache misses, you know, and most of the time we'd be doing that sort of thing on code which isn't executed very much. So we can't afford to do this kind of, you know, really code expanding optimization on every single function. No. We want to, and the compiler doesn't really understand when you as a, you know, making a application would think that's okay to do versus not. Yes.
How does the compiler decide how many times to unroll the loop?
My impression is that most of the optimizations you see compilers doing are heuristics. They're educated guesses refined from what's worked on prior programs. In some cases, there might be some sort of like performance model or something, but I think that's relatively uncommon. Okay, so let's look at probably the most pernicious example of this first issue I talked about, that the compiler needs to handle corner cases. And the biggest example of this problem is something called aliasing, which is when we have two names for the same value. And a simple example of this is we have this twiddle function here. It takes an x and a y via a pointer, and it adds y to x twice. And you might say, okay, well, the way we should do this is we should just say add 2 times y to x. And that should be faster because we're loading from the cache list. So that seems like the code we want to generate. But the compiler cannot do that. That is not a legal compilation of this method. And the reason why is that we can call the function like this, that we could have both of the values we pass to the function be pointers to the same thing. And if that thing is, say, 1, we do 1 plus equals 1, 2, so it gets 2. 2 plus equals 2, the result would be 4. If we did the version I was trying to do of 2 times y, I'd end up with 3. So my clever idea of doing the 2 times, and only loading y once, is illegal. It's not a valid compilation of this. And this is going to prevent our compiler from doing an optimization that you as a human would probably say, well, no one should call the function like that. But the compiler can't make that assumption, because it's well-defined what this code should do, and it should handle that case where we have 2 pointers to the same thing. So questions about this example of aliasing, having 2 different names for the same value? In this case, the names are star px and star py. Okay, so you might, yes, back there? Okay, so you might complain that this example looks really contrived. Surely this never happens in, that often. But unfortunately, aliasing issues are everywhere. So as an example, here I have a function that takes a matrix and adds up the rows into, a list of row sums. And in this function, the compiler needs to worry that what I might have done is I might have passed pointers to parts of the same array, 2 different parts of the same array as a result in matrix. We as a human, that's a stupid way to call this function, but that's something the compiler needs to worry about. And if that were the case, it might be the case that setting result of say, 0 is going to change what I read later on for matrix of, 5. If they're just pointers to different parts of the same array. We as humans know that that's a stupid way to call this function. No one's going to do that. But the compiler, says, well, that's what the code means. I have to do what the code says. So it can't sort of do something where, like we probably want it to do, where it keeps result of row in a register while we're doing this inner loop here. That is not allowed, because the compiler needs to deal with what if result and matrix overlap. It needs to have some code to handle that. And the simplest way is just to always write to memory when we add to result of row. Yes? How would always writing resolve the conflict? So we're not keeping things from aliasing, but we're just doing what C says should happen. And C says that if these overlap, we should have this thing where if I write to result, it should change what I read later for matrix, and that should give me a different number. So the compiler's implementing that, even though we as humans know that's not something I care about in implementing correctly. I don't care about that case, but it doesn't know that. And, you would complain if your compiler, tried to make guesses about what you didn't care about and got it wrong. It gave you the wrong answer. Now, you might say, what can we do about this? And there is something we can do without going all the way to writing assembly that to tell the compiler that, no, there's no aliasing here. And that's we can use a temporary value. If I write the sum variable here, the compiler knows that it's not an alias for anything in matrix because I haven't taken any pointers to it. I can't possibly have a pointer to sum because there are no pointers to sum anywhere. And therefore, it knows that it can keep that in the register. And sort of this is the simplest way of giving the compiler that extra information that no aliasing isn't possible. And these two versions of SumRows, if you run them on compilers, you'll actually often see a difference in performance. So I run this on an old GCC, and we have two lines here. The blue line is the version 1 with the aliasing, and the green line is version 2. So you see the aliasing, you know, hurt our performance because it forced the compiler to keep storing things into the cache when it could have kept them in a register. This is a graph of cycles per element, basically. And we can see we have this gap. But this seems like a relatively minor effect. But another thing that aliasing does is it prevents the compiler from doing other optimizations. So like we saw that example of where the compiler knew how to use these fancy instructions that like add multiple values at once. When you have aliasing like this, probably the compiler can't really do that safely. So this has a bigger effect at higher optimization levels. That higher optimization levels, with the aliasing, the compiler said, don't know how to optimize that further because I have to deal with what if I'm reading the value I just wrote. But with the version where that was eliminated, it could do something, you know, fancier because it knew that wasn't a problem. And this comes up frequently with other sorts of optimizations. That eliminating aliasing will prevent the compiler from handling these corner cases, which will allow it to like pattern match some optimization it knows how to do when it doesn't have to worry about what if I'm reading the value I just wrote sort of issues. What is n? N is the n that we're passing to the function.
So why would the cycles per count continue to go down as n increases?
Question, why would the cycles per count continue to go down as n increases?
Count n, is that what count is?
Count here is n, yes. Or actually, sorry, I think count is n squared, because count is n squared, yeah. It's the number of iterations of this innermost loop. So that's normalized to make it be that, you know, we should have it leveled off. Other questions? Okay. So something you might say is that couldn't the compiler like do something in this case where it says, check if these overlap and do something in one case versus not? It absolutely could, but it needs to figure out that that makes sense. So maybe some more compilers will figure out to like do this sort of code. But even this is kind of hard for the compiler to do, because if you think of what this means in terms of code size, even if the compiler checks, oh, I could generate much better code if these don't overlap, when it generates the version of the code, it needs to generate like two copies of the function. And if this is not actually used very much, that's just going to make your executable huge if it does this all the time. So showed aliasing with this example and some other examples where you can see aliasing. So one thing is in cache blocking. Often what we did in cache blocking is we transformed the code so we should have reuse of a value. And one thing we'd like is after we've done cache blocking and loop unrolling like this, we'd really like some of these values we're using over and over again, like say this ai of n times I times n plus k, to be kept in a register. But here, the compiler can't do that. And the reason why is that the compiler, to do that, needs to prove that this value is not another name for this value. Because if it is, then we have to reread it after it's written. And we have the same kind of problem with, say, B here. We need to prove that it's not the same as this value Just like we have to prove that this is not the same as either of these values. And typically, that's not something the compiler is going to be able to do or bother to do. And this means that the compiler, you know, can't do our register reuse that you might have expected looking at this code as a human, right? You say, oh, we have the same value twice. Of course, the compiler is going to load into register. But even if the compiler detects that that would be useful, often it can't really do that because of aliasing, because it has to worry about this corner case. So a fix you can do is you can explicitly say, hey, load that a copy of that value. So you can write code like this where I've said, I need to use these elements of A, load them into a temporary variable, and if you have few enough of these, the compiler should keep them in registers, and you'll get that reuse you hoped. Questions about this strategy here. So this is sometimes, as the slide says, called register blocking. We're kind of loading a block of values into registers. Yes? So conflicts here. So yeah, question is, why could we have problems with aliasing here? So with A here, so this element of A, let's say A and C are both pointers to different parts of the same array. So in that case, if we choose the right indexes, they'll be the same thing. And the concern is that the indices might have been set up such that this element of A is the same as this element of C or the following element of C there. And if that's the case, then the value we load for A in the first line here is not the same value we want to load for the third line, which means we can't just keep it in a register in between those two lines. Like we want to. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes. Why can't we just check they're not the same? We absolutely could check they're not the same. So the question then is, how many checks are we going to have to do? So there are ways we can do this, and when compilers do these sorts of checks, what they'll probably end up doing is they'll generate code that's something broadly like this, where they'll say, at the beginning, do these things overlap overall? Well, that's a pretty complex thing to figure out, right? It needs to figure out what's the maximum index of A we're going to access, and is this like going to find me what I want? So some compilers will sometimes do that, but it's not an easy thing to do. I wouldn't expect it to happen very often. Maybe that will change in future compilers, maybe not. But if we're like doing the checks on this loop level, then that would be like adding like 4, 8 if statements to the loop, which would clearly be really slow relative to these simple like addition and multiplication operations. But yes, the compiler could check, but that's hard to do efficiently. Other questions? Yeah. Question is, would there not be a problem with A conflicting with any of the C values below the first two? So if we assume that we aren't reusing this value of A, yeah, right, there shouldn't be a problem. But in this case, if we want to have the same A be used between iterations of this loop, yes, there would be an issue. We'd have to worry about every single iteration interfering. Other questions? Yeah. So why am I not putting the value of C I'm writing to in variables? So if I put, I could do that, and that would help for these B, right? That would have the same effect as far as allowing the Bs to be reused. It wouldn't help allow us to reuse As between iterations if I didn't put the As in a variable, right? If I only put the Cs in a variable, I still have to reload the values from A every iteration just in case I overwrote them. Because remember, each iteration of this loop here is writing to different j's. So if I was loading every in the inner loop, if I was loading from this, it would have to worry that it would be the same as a C I wrote in the prior iteration. And therefore, I'd end up reloading the value every iteration, which this code should avoid. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's do a little exercise on aliasing. So we have two versions of a function that look kind of the same, but the compiler can't like generate the second one. They aren't equivalent because of aliasing problems. And so which question is, which of these are examples where we would have that? We would have aliasing two names for the same value that could cause different answers. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have A, B, C, D? Okay, so we have actual consensus. Had this morning lecture, but not last year, as I recall. So, and that is indeed what I got. So the way I kind of reason about this quickly is I say, you know, are we reading a value after we write to it in any of the cases? If that doesn't happen, I don't have to worry about aliasing at all. If I'm never reading a value I previously wrote, it's not going to be a problem. And this quickly eliminates A. Even though we have overlapping you know, S1 and S2, we're only reading from those, we're not writing. So we're never writing something that we're going to read later. For C, it also eliminates C, because what I'm writing, or wait, so for D, it eliminates D, because I'm always writing to things that are A0 to 100, to 1,000 rather, and reading from indexes of A after 1,000, I know that I'm never, you know, writing something I'm going to read later. In the case of C, we have this example where we're writing things, sorry, we're reading ahead of what we're writing. Sorry. So even though we do end up writing to, you know, A of 10 and reading from it, we read from it before we write to it. And that's true in both versions. Even though I'm doing the writes in a slightly different order, you know, I'm ahead by 10, that's going to be enough that I'm never going to read something that I previously wrote with either version. So B is where we have a problem. And we can see by like looking at what happens specifically to find out if this actually causes a conflict. And we can see if we look at, say, the first few iterations that here I've just expanded what this loop is for I equals 1 and 2 for version 1. And we have, you know, A of 1, because that's D, is A of 0 plus A of 0. And then we use that A of 1 we just wrote to compute A of 2. In the second version, we compute with the original A of 1, this temp 2, which gets stored in A of 2. So A of 2 is going to disagree between the two versions, so we in fact have an issue where aliasing is giving us different answers in each case. So question back there? Sorry, why would the compiler just store A1 in the register? You mean this A1?
Yeah, yeah.
So because that's the output of the function, right?
Oh.
Right, the function is meant to write to that destination array. So we have to write there eventually. Other questions? Okay. So one last comment about aliasing. So aliasing is probably the biggest reason why the compiler won't do cache blocking for you. Because cache blocking, you know, is changing how we interleave these reads of A and B with C. And if these overlap, it's really hard to reason about whether we can actually flip those loops. And the compiler basically can't do it unless it can prove they don't overlap. Usually it can't. Maybe cleverer compilers could like generate code where it checks if they overlap and then does cache blocking. But this is a big reason why you don't see compilers just doing cache blocking for you. Because of aliasing, it's not actually a safe transformation to your code. Like it would produce different answers in those corner cases where our pointers are overlapping. So let's talk about, we talked about why compilers don't do cache blocking. Let's talk about why compilers don't do loop unrolling. Loop unrolling doesn't seem to have these aliasing problems. So why doesn't compilers do it? So I alluded to some of the reasons. So one of the reasons is that if we do loop unrolling all the time, we're going to be unrolling some loops that aren't very important, but we're going to make our code a lot bigger. And if we make our code bigger everywhere, that's going to mean our program's going to have trouble fitting in the instruction cache. It's going to run slower. It's also going to be bigger on disk. That's inconvenient. And we have a lot of loops that like run 3 iterations typically, right? That's not going to be worth unrolling versus the cost of the extra instruction cache misses from trying to store those in our code. And also, if we have a loop which is really expensive to execute, so like we have a loop with a function call in it, if that function call is really slow, like if it's printing to the screen, probably it's not worth unrolling that loop because, you know, the loop overhead's going to be insignificant compared to how slow that function call is. And the compiler can't really know in advance what loops fit this category. If it sees code like this, it doesn't know how many times the loop is going to be executed. It can make guesses, but You know, for all it knows, some variable could usually be 1 or 2. In which case, unrolling the loop is just adding extra work to handle the edge cases of, like, you know, the leftover and so on. It doesn't know whether some function is something really complicated or not. Just doesn't have that information that you as a human reading the code could probably figure out. You could probably say, this is an important loop, that isn't. Or you could do some work to figure that out, that the compiler just doesn't have that information. And also, you know, sometimes we'll have loops where the compiler can't do loop unrolling because it can't figure out the loop bound. So here, if I have a loop where the bound is a global variable, the compiler needs to worry, what if some function changes that global variable? We as a human might know that shouldn't happen, but that's something the compiler needs to worry about, which means it can't do this transformation because it might be the case that whether the global variable is odd, you know, whether you have that leftover case changes as the function runs and will do the wrong number of calls to some function. And there are going to be similar issues for the other big optimization we talked about with loops, which was multiple accumulators. With multiple accumulators, we have all the downsides of loop unrolling, plus we have extra register use. And those are registers we're not using for other things, potentially. So if the multiple accumulators aren't actually useful, if it's not a loop that's executed very many times, and so on, we're just, you know, slowing down the other code around it in order to support multiple accumulators. And multiple accumulators are only useful if we likely have a latency bottleneck. The compiler doesn't have enough information, typically, to know whether that makes sense or not. So it's probably not going to do that for you. So that's about why compilers don't do the loop optimizations we talked about. So next I'd like to talk about an optimization that compilers sometimes do with an example of a loop with a function call. So here I have this very simple function, sum with limit. So it adds two numbers together and clamps them at 10,000. And we have this add with limit, and the straightforward sort of assembly for this has a bunch of instructions just to call the function. We have to move its arguments into place. We have to call it, and it has to return. So this is around 4 instructions we're executing just to call the function. And kind of like with loops, we had these extra instructions we executed just to, like, deal with the indexes and jumping to the beginning of the loop. Here we have extra instructions just to call this function and return from it. And there's a faster alternative, like with loop unrolling, where we get rid of this overhead, and that's we're called inlining the call. So taking the out-of-line code of the function and moving it in the line of the loop that's executed. So we'll just put the function code in the loop, making the appropriate substitutions to the registers it's using to match the context of the loop. Or what the equivalent would be in C is just like copying the body of the function, changing the variable names appropriately into the loop. So this is an optimization that's, you know, it's going to save a bunch of time. It has similar issues to loop unrolling. You know, so we're avoiding extra instructions, so it should be faster. It also has this special property of freeing up registers because we don't have to, like, do the call or save register stuff because we don't have a function call anymore. We don't have to use the argument registers and so on. But it's not always faster. In particular, if we always inline functions, you know, we might end up with 10, 20, 30 copies of a function. And that's going to be a lot worse for our instruction cache. And we'll often make a program run a lot slower, especially if most of those cases where it's inlined aren't in code that executes very often, like a loop, or a loop that executes a lot, at least. Now, inlining is a very simple transformation for compilers to do, but the main issue is, like, whether it's actually going to help. So compilers typically have these guesses about when inlining is good, and there's typically two constraints they have. So one is that they're going to try to make some guesses that will keep code from getting a lot bigger. And the typical rules compilers will have is that they'll check the size of the function, and if it's small enough, they'll inline it. And they have some conservative threshold because they don't want to have this reputation for producing multi-megabyte binaries all the time. Another heuristic they'll often have is that if they can prove a function is called exactly once, like it's a static function that's used exactly once, they might inline it even if it's big, because that won't make the code any bigger. Compilers usually won't inline across .o files. And there's a good reason for this, which is that, because the function might change, right, before we make the executable. They can't inline that if you change the .o file. So this means that if add with limit was in another file and compiled separately, that we would not see this inlining happen. The compiler just wouldn't have the information to do that. It'd have to worry that I changed add with limit in some way before I made the executable. It'd have to handle that. Now, I said compilers make these sort of guesses about when inlining is good. There are ways you can manipulate that besides sort of the very direct way of what we saw of just copying the code in, which works fine, might be a good option for our assignments. Compilers often have ways of telling the compiler, hey, please inline this function. Trust me, it's a good idea. Or please don't inline this function. Trust me, it's a bad idea, even if it looks small enough. In addition, there are solutions in practice to this inlining across .o file. So obviously, the way object files work that we learned, you can't do inlining across them because the function you're inlining could change. But some compilers have a feature called link time optimization, where basically what they'll do is rather than putting the machine code in the .o files, they'll put some intermediate representation and they'll generate the machine code at link time. Now, this is a lot slower, but it's what you might do if you really care about getting all the optimizations your compiler can do. And it's not going to be the default because it requires not using normal object files. Doesn't work with the object files we learned. So questions about inlining? Yes. So the question is, when I talk to these hints, is that referring to a certain command? So the way compilers have you specify this varies. So in GCC, for example, you can declare a function with this special keyword, something like attribute always inline with a bunch of underscores and parentheses, and then your function in foo. And that's how you give the hint. Other compilers have completely different syntax for this, but it's a common compiler feature to have some way of labeling a function in the code as definitely inline this, or definitely don't inline this, or try to inline this, maybe, sort of thing. Okay. Other questions? So that's where I'll finish off today. So next time we'll talk about some few more optimizations, including most notably using vector instructions.